Your most recent work is a compilation of essays and criticism, which is tinged with the theme of distraction, essentially pointing out how our limited quantity of attention is constantly being bombarded and commodified by pharmaceuticals, legal, illegal, data collection, content, et cetera. Consequently, diminishing quality, I would say, is a part of what you're trying to get across. And the work explores to what extent this phenomenon may or may not be modern. How did you decide that 2018 was the moment to explore this particular idea and in this format versus, say, the medium of fiction?
I think I also tackled it in fiction, but in a way, I think that the it's all in a sense of fiction. There was an increasing interest in the idea of attention, as if everyone could agree on what that was. As if when you said attention, everyone immediately had the same idea, you know, as to what that word meant, even though there are neurologists who point to the inner workings of various structures of the brain and who say that it's a function of the mind. You know, there are certainly in the humanities, and then in the antecedent humanities, in religious literature, it's a state of being, let's say, and not a function. And I felt like the world was full of these assumptions about, one, what attention was, and two, the fact that it was, in fact, a diminishing quantity. And it seemed to me to be a panic, almost a moral panic. And like most moral panics, it seemed to have some profit-making end to it. I don't know whether I actually believe that any of it is true. In fact, I'm not really sure that attention exists as a, you know, a single entity that we could kind of point to and all agree on. I think it was I saw around me people creating an artificial resource called attention in order to then create a sense of artificial scarcity and panic people into buying solutions for it, or at least into an entire market of if not self-help, then some degree of self-inquiry and time management that has turned everyone into workers, even when they're home. And I felt, in a sense, that these were false categories. And so I wanted to write a book about how, when we're talking about attention, we're talking about the entire world, and there was almost no way to focus.
But you go back a little bit, I say a little bit, you go back to Babylon, you know, you go back about everywhere. I never really fully understood. Do you think this idea is modern, this commoditization?
Oh, I think that the idea that time is money is modern in the way that historians use the word modern, which is they begin with the modern period, which is now ancient history in a way. Sure, I believe, you know, it really begins with early management studies. But I don't, I think the idea of attention has changed considerably, you know, over from when we can begin to recognize words that have some similar valence to the way that we use it today. You know, there was an idea that prayer is attention, and that when one was paying attention to something, you know, kind of greater than oneself. There was almost the occasionalist philosophical idea that the world is God's attention, and that when God stops paying attention to the world, it ceases to exist. I think that there were certainly ideas of attention being ways of demarcating categories when people are kind of in the early days of scientific classification, like the sort of binomial classification of Linnaeus.
It's kind of a class thing too, huh? I mean, like if you're an academic or like you said, you're a monk or if you're a priest, you have much more time on your hands to focus or to have attention in a sense.
Right, and I think again, it's you know, there is this modern notion of attention of what we spend our time doing, and it's entirely quantitative. And you do see a turn from the qualitative nature of attention to the quantitative nature of attention around the end of the 18th century. Certainly, the you know, Rousseau being the height, but also the end of the qualitative approach.
Yeah.
And you begin seeing then ideas of not just time, but also the return on attention. You know, if I'm investing my time, what is the return on my investment? And it becomes itself invested with all of the concept becomes invested with all of these financial metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that really begins happening right after the Enlightenment.
Yeah, that's a good, interesting thought. It's an interesting discussion altogether. Let me pivot slightly. Let me ask you, how do you view your place in the American Jewish literary canon in a century where the intellectual literary figure is on the decline, you know, more than ever, in favor of more easily recognizable things like brands? Or people as brands, as I would say.
Wow, those are my choices. Be a Jewish American or be a brand. Those are pretty shitty choices.
Well, I mean, do you think that that's your choice? I mean,
No, those are the two things you mentioned. I don't know. I think that...
I say that because so many people mention, you know, this is like the decade of the brand, you know, as a person.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking to someone with no real internet profile, no social media, so I don't know that I really...
Well, that's what I mean, like, do you think it's more difficult for you at this moment, or... And I wanted to pull this together with, I'm sorry, maybe it's a, you know, a difficult question, but, you know, within the authors that maybe you see yourself in, like with then Philip Roth or within the other, you know, Saul Bellow, do they have a different experience because of this, because of the internet or because of this moment?
Well, I mean, I think that they were, they had all of the benefits and all of the drawbacks of being in a far more parochial environment than the one we're in now. I mean, they were, of course, read by the world, but their writing had, and I don't use the word parochial in a negative way, but it had a both a parochial focus and also a parochial audience. I think the thing that everyone is facing now, I mean, not just me, but everyone who writes at all, is that they're expected to be read by the world. You know, let's take out for a moment the economic considerations, right? The economic considerations are you make a piece of art, you make a piece of writing, and it needs to have, it needs to be IP, right? It needs to be intellectual property. It needs to have a potential to be a movie, a television series, a streaming series, right? Let's take all of that kind of idea of the equation that people really, most people write books today really in order to make TV shows or make movies.
Yeah.
And it seems like a wasteful and time-intensive way to make something, to make narrative. But throwing that out, the real artistic question now is that if you are publishing now, you are publishing to the globe. You are being read by people everywhere.
Yeah.
And the larger an audience gets, there is a tendency to dumbing things down. And that's because you can speak most intimately to smaller numbers of people. I mean, the way that you communicate to your family, the way that you communicate to a spouse, a partner, is a phenomenally intimate mode of communication, right? You have all this shorthand, you have all of these abbreviations, you know, you understand one another because you've built up a common vocabulary. And so sometimes you don't even need to say anything, it's a glance. And your audience, your small family or partner audience will understand you. So the larger it grows from the family to the community to, let's say, the state of the national language, the regional, you know, the regional language and the national language, and now the international language, which is just about as big as you can get, you know, unless aliens start reading us, it's really, it becomes less and less intimate because you're dealing with people who bring different ideas to your work about how language operates. You know, so many people in the world speak English, but the English they speak is business English. The English they speak is computer English, right? And so I think that the real challenge I think facing everyone is not about branding or identity or how one's read, but it's can you keep the specificity or the beauty of the parochial, the beauty of the detail, of the local detail, of the regional detail, and can it be appreciated widely? And I think that that's the first thing that goes when people are writing, you know, literature for the world. You know, this category that we have called world literature is just as bad as world music. It just sounds like bullshit.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. That makes sense. Again, let me pivot One thing approached, theme approached quite frequently in your work is male sexuality, I would say, and quite frankly, the honesty that you bring to it. Mm-hmm. At such a precarious moment with the rise of the Me Too movement and all the self-reflection that it demands mm-hmm. upon the 21st century male, I would say, how has your writing been affected by that, particularly keeping in mind the current demonization of the sexuality and Philip Roth's like Portnoy's complaint, for instance, or something?
I think it's good we have some scandal. It means someone's interested in something, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think I'm very wary about anything that tells me what I can and what I can't write. Mm-hmm. And it's my natural instinct to always do the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. I think that the socialist realist element of literature, which is not depicting the world as it is, but depicting the world as you'd like it to be, mm-hmm. I think it's not limited to countries laboring under Stalinist rule. Mm-hmm. But I think that for me, it really does come down to that question of, am I interested in portraying a reality? Mm-hmm. Or in portraying a utopia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's been some things that I've written where I've been interested in portraying, you know, a world as it, you know, as I would like it to be according to certain rules, even a dystopia according to certain principles. Mm-hmm. But for me, the real beauty in literature is to see the depiction of the world as it is. And that will always be my, be my self-appointed task, whether it's about sex, whether it's about money, mm-hmm. Whether it's about any sort of political issue. Mm-hmm. I think unless we can go to some place in this world where we can freely see and freely hear mm-hmm. a depiction of what people truly think, if we don't have that, then I think we've lost an enormous access who are part of our humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting thought. What about the techniques that you use? I mean, is using your own vulnerability, or at least ostensibly and ostensible honesty, you know, whether it's true or not true, it's for your protagonist, it is. Mm-hmm. Is that a technique for navigating difficult topics such as sexuality? For instance, at times your meta-protagonist in Book of Numbers evokes his estranged wife, saying things like, Rach would call that sexist, but with mm-hmm. regard to potentially insensitive comments he makes about certain women. Mm-hmm. He also discusses, like, frankly, low semen count in the couple's attempts at having a child and mm-hmm. other topics as well.
The job of a novelist sort of always, in my mind, should devolve onto the characters. Mm-hmm. In other words, I see it as my job to try and depict the world as it is through, or as I see it, through a number of different characters' points of views. And the next level or stage of that is granting those characters the ability to try and inhabit the minds of yet other characters, right? So the sort of each character becomes the novelist of the novel, right? There are parts where I'm going through the narrator's mind and investigating what he's thinking. And there are times when I want what he's thinking to be what his ex-wife is thinking, or what his friend is thinking, or what, you know, his employer is thinking. Mm-hmm. And I all of these, you know, technical strategies, let's say, or tactics are really essentially just the principle of transformation, allowing any person in a book to mentally inhabit anyone else in the book. Mm-hmm. Just like I can mentally inhabit any of them.
Mm-hmm. So it's more getting into the character's head than some technique for getting across an idea for you.
Oh,
do you
absolutely.
Try to get across ideas? I mean,
no,
or do you more
no, not at all. I mean, I do try and get across ideas only insofar as they can stage dramatic action. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think the most useful technique is to have somebody say something in a book that you don't believe, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. so you can write against it, or you can write a character that contradicts that. But no, purely ideas. I don't really, you know, as I get older, I don't know what ideas mean anymore. No, I mean, you know, in the sense of like, it's very clear to me from any morning waking up and turning on the news or reading a newspaper or magazine that like, that ideas don't exist except within emotions.
Yeah.
And that to truly talk to somebody who has an idea that isn't surrounded by layers of emotions, neuroses, frustrations,
mm-hmm.
guilt, resentments,
yeah.
It's almost impossible. I mean, you'd have to talk to a pure scientist, and even those people have ideas couched in ambition
mm-hmm.
and you know, and a desire not to be wrong.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to see, you know, to say that I wanted to communicate, you know, a thought, no, I want to communicate, every thought with me is, you know, has to come from an emotional gesture that exposes the vulnerabilities or the weaknesses of the character.
Is this lack of truly having the existence of ideas, is that what you wanted to say with your final essay of Attention?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways I wanted to, I think that if you want to talk about resentments
mm-hmm.
and you want to talk about vulnerabilities and truth with them, I think that one of my great frustrations was to come of age as a writer of fiction in the age of nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, beyond people saying, confusing me with my narrators, confusing me with my characters, and
mm-hmm.
beyond the fact that almost everywhere I go, I get the question, did that really happen or is that true? I think that it's that there is a premium placed on the idea of facticity, that a fact is something that's carved into stone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, while it's, we can understand the rhetoric of the dangers involved with eroding that that faith, and so not believing in our news, believing that, you know, that our news is fake news, believing that everything said by every politician is a lie, you know, blah blah blah. I think that these things are sort of these are ideas that we can, that are long established. For me, it's the terror of truth and falsehood as rigid categories, as if there's no overlap and there's no gradations between the two, as if
mm-hmm.
there's no agendas behind someone telling the truth or agendas or motives behind someone telling a lie. And I think that I wanted to express my frustration with living in such a black and white, Manichaean
yeah.
society.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thought. Your ultimate essay in Attention that we've been discussing a little bit, it details a history of Western ideas. I'll go through this, you know, for the listener. On Attention or Focus, as you've said in the essay, it's about nothing but also about everything,
mm-hmm.
from Augustine to automatons, from Freud to methamphetamines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This technique comes across as quintessentially American in its meandering form to me, almost, I would say, Emersonian. But your wellspring of knowledge doesn't tend to come from the American founders or from the... You talk more about the Jewish traditions of Europe and post-war
mm-hmm.
immigration to America than you would Emerson or even, you know, 18th century Americans from what
mm-hmm.
I've read. How would you view the organization of this essay with regard to your own personal influences? How did it come about from that?
Well, it's funny because I see it as French, man.
You think so?
I don't know. I mean, look at Rousseau. I mean,
yeah.
those, you know,
maybe 18th century French,
right? Or like Chateaubriand's memoirs. Or
yeah,
something,
yeah.
You know?
I can see that.
Sure.
But I mean, I guess in modern France, you would have a problematique, and then you have to get from.
Oh yeah,
this,
yeah.
It's
no.
all
I
about
mean,
clarity.
Every culture has fallen and become more boring since the.
Yeah,
century.
I guess so.
Yeah, yeah. I don't. I actually don't see it as American. I don't see it as. I see it as really of the internet. I
okay.
see it as of technology. I think it's the access to these to this data point. I mean, what do you do with information? Is these are enormous questions of our time, right? When information, when facts are so cheap, so I mean, they're so easy to obtain. Do they still continue to be the authorities that we hope they are?
Mm-hmm.
Right, when we can go online and equally cite statistics that say opposite things, right, and then attempt to prove through citations that we are both, even though we contradict each other, we both are accurate, mm-hmm. right? I mean, this to me is the kind of great joke of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the way in which you can access all times and all places instantly.
Mm-hmm.
But through that access, you also devalue them.
Mm-hmm.
And so a large part of it is a parody. I mean, I hate to be the person sitting here explaining my book and saying it's a joke,
yeah.
but in a lot of ways, it is a it's a way of explaining that the chaos sort of behind people's use of the internet is really the thing that's unexpressed by the internet, which is to say, if I looked at your browsing history,
yeah.
right? And I looked at, you know, you looked up, you know, what kind of shoes am I going to buy, you know, followed by what are the directions here, followed, you know, by, you know, porn and a history of World War I,
yeah.
right? I would I have a picture of you? I mean, the thing that I'm lacking is what is the mind that's connecting all of these points?
Mm-hmm.
What is the intentionality?
Yeah.
What is the emotional drive? And that is never going to be expressed through data. It's only going to be expressed through the through line of narrative that coheres these isolated information points.
Yeah.
And so in a lot of ways for me, the mission, if there is a mission of literature, is providing that narrative through line that that makes people equal to the task of their own information, that
yeah.
makes people the masters of their own mm-hmm. information.
I see that as at this moment. I think that your work is of this moment in the sense that reading your work, it does give that sense of you having Googled some of the facts. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to say you don't know Babylonian
sure.
history, or you don't know this, but sometimes you really do come across, and I think that you're not trying to hide that. That you're there's a lot of fact in the way that we would be like, hey, who built 17th century Lyon's architecture,
and
add that.
And there lies throughout it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was an essay that is in that book. It's not the last essay. I'm not going to tell you what it is. Where it's all based on research. Research in quotes of Wikipedia pages that I secretly wrote,
mm-hmm.
right? So yeah. and these facts that I put out there have now become facts in the world,
yeah.
and I've seen other people reproduce them. I've seen major American newspapers reproduce them,
yeah.
and so and it's about just the invention of fact
mm-hmm.
and that the simple invention of fact,
uh-huh.
And so it's not as a question of me sitting there. Kind of looking things up, and then drawing these connections. It's me also trying to seed these connections in order to destabilize a sort of regime of an appeal to authority or regime of an appeal to authenticity, which I think is ultimately fruitless and imaginatively limiting.
Yeah, I had a professor in college who used to change the Wikipedia pages the night before the test.
That's a wonderful idea.
Anyway, pivot again. One of your traits as a fiction writer, I believe, mm-hmm. undoubtedly, is flexibility, which I find interesting. In Book of Numbers, the scene in Dubai where your protagonist goes to the interview, the tech mogul, and ends up fighting a wealthy businessman mm-hmm. and at the threshold of an elevator in the middle of a swank hotel over the beating of the fight being over the beating of the latter's wife. It kind of has an elegant playfulness with language, particularly in its meticulous use of alliteration and jeu de mots. What was your mindset in deciding to write that section in that particular style, and what is your general mindset and how you move between styles when you're writing fiction?
Oh, I think that it's you know, it's a thriller scene, man. When you got to write a thriller scene, you got to write the thriller language. I don't know. I mean, I think that I've always thought two things. One is there's the postmodern idea that a language needs to sort of be appropriate to the genre that you are appropriating from,
yeah.
right? So, you know, you can have a thriller scene in a book, but it's written in a thriller style. Next to a love scene in a book that's written in a love scene style.
Yeah.
But then I also like the idea of writing against those styles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of let's have a scene that would be conventionally in its outward, you know, in its outlines would be a thriller scene,
mm-hmm.
but let's write it in a love scene voice, or let's
mm-hmm.
write, you know, let's give it the wrong rhetoric to wake people up.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's too much automation in the way people view things and hear things and read things And I think that every once in a while there needs to be that little hiccup that wakes people up. And so the idea was to use the language against the theme.